So I've been reading consecutively from first canto, second canto, now well into the third canto. So if it's all right with all of you, I'll just continue. A couple of verses and very nice. It's the conclusion of chapter 6, the creation of the universal form is the title of the chapter, and it's the concluding remarks made by Maitreya Muni. Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. Subject matter that he's just explained, the universal form subject matter, is a very difficult to understand subject matter. It's a difficult to explain subject matter, and he's saying it at the end of the chapter. Not just the subject matter of universal form, but the topics about the personality of Godhead. Because the potencies of the personality of Godhead are unlimited, and a living being, even maybe very qualified, but a living being is limited. So how is the limited to describe the unlimited? And he's expressed that I've done so only insofar as I heard from, well, he heard from Krishna, because Maitreya had just been direct audience to Krishna speaking Uddhava Gita to Uddhava. He was personally present when Krishna was speaking. And in addition, Krishna told Maitreya very soon, Vidura is going to come, and I'd like you to pass on to Maitreya, to Vidura, all that you've heard from me, like a special invitation, a special assignment given to Maitreya, and a special recognition given to Vidura about his importance and the importance of, to Krishna, the importance of Vidura receiving the same message. And of course, that connects with Vidura then returning later back to Hastinapur, and Vidura delivering Dhritarashtra. Of course, the conversation was a little different than this one. He blasted him, and Dhritarashtra took it, and Dhritarashtra left his attachments and left his body voluntarily in a much better state of consciousness than he would have been had Vidura not delivered him. Vidura also, because previous to his departure from the royal palace of the Pandavas, or the Kauravas, Kaurava dynasty, he was considered very saintly, at least very learned amongst all the members. Even Dhritarashtra regularly took counsel from him because he understood Vidura was very wise. But when Vidura came back, he was more than wise. He was considered, and rightly so, that he was on a Mahabhagavata platform. And he had achieved that through his detachment, leaving, going on pilgrimage, becoming purified by visiting the holy places, becoming enlightened by hearing from the saintly persons in all of those places, and finally hearing from Maitreya, where it's described in the first canto that he heard to his full satisfaction until he became elevated just by that process of hearing to the stage of spiritual perfection. Maitreya is saying the same thing. Maitreya is saying that one can achieve spiritual perfection. Maitreya achieved it, and he passed it on to Vidura, the stage of spiritual perfection, by that same hearing process, by hearing both the speaking and the hearing. In this section, it's explicitly stated. It's like our experience, but it's explicitly stated that when one hears, even from a qualified source, one hears from a bona fide spiritual master, one isn't going to remember everything that one heard, not in Kali Yuga anyway, and one is not going to assimilate everything that one has heard. But it's that which you've heard and that which you've assimilated is that which you can pass on. But that doesn't disqualify the speaker, Maitreya, saying that about himself. And rather what he's saying is, I have this disqualification, but nonetheless I'm expressing as much as I can. You mentioned this earlier, that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami uses the phrase that a bird can fly as high in the sky only as far as his wings will carry him, and different birds can fly at different heights. So similarly, each person can express that which they've received in disciplic succession in a different way. But this is the good news. Krishna accepts that service. Whatever your height flying capacity is, whatever your wings will carry you capacity may be. And by that process, capacity increases. One becomes further purified. One becomes, as this section is describing, one becomes part of Krishna's paraphernalia. That's what Prabhupada writes. Just as Krishna is all spiritual, similarly the topics of Krishna are all spiritual. And one who hears with one's ear those topics of Krishna, which are all spiritual, one becomes spiritualized and like unto Krishna, in quality like Krishna. But because our capacity is small, our wattage is small, we don't illumine so brightly. But the Krishna potency is the illumination strength. According to our capacity, we can exhibit that. That's what Maitreya is saying about himself and the process of hearing Krishna Katha and presenting Krishna Katha. It makes both the speaker and the receiver spiritualized or spiritually qualified, spiritually elevated. So here's the last two verses of this chapter, chapter 6, canto 3, text 39. The wonderful potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bewildering even to the jugglers. It doesn't say word jugglers, it says the jugglers. And listen to how Prabhupada plays poetry with that word in the purport. That potential power, that the unlimited potency of Krishna, that potential power is unknown even to the self-sufficient Lord. So it is certainly unknown to others. Prabhupada, in the previous purport, gave the example of Arjuna. By Krishna's grace, he was enabled to see the universal form. And Arjuna then described what he saw in that universal form. And he saw hands and faces and eyes and parts of bodies in all directions, and he couldn't see the beginning or the middle or the end. So Prabhupada's comment is, if Arjuna, seeing the universal form, couldn't see the beginning, middle, or end, then what to speak of a speculator who hasn't seen and is trying to estimate? And now, in this verse, Maitreya is saying even the Lord himself cannot see the limit of his own potencies. And Prabhupada begins the purport with one of his favorite Dr. Frog presentations, the froggish philosophers and mundane wranglers in science and mathematical calculation may not believe in the inconceivable potency of the Supreme Personality Godhead, but they are sometimes puzzled by the wonderful jugglery of man and nature. Such jugglers and magicians of the mundane world are actually puzzled by the jugglery of the Supreme Lord in his transcendental activities, and they try to adjust the bewilderment by saying that it is all mythology. There is, however, nothing impossible or mythological in the Supreme Omnipotent Person. The most wonderful puzzle for the mundane wranglers is that while they remain calculating the length and breadth of the unlimited potency of the Supreme Person, his faithful devotees are set free from the bondage of encagement simply by appreciating the wonderful jugglery of the Supreme Lord in the practical field. The devotees of the Lord see the wonderful dexterity in everything which they come in contact with in all circumstances of eating, sleeping, working, etc. He gives the example of the banyan tree. Within the banyan tree, there are so many seeds. Within each seed of the banyan tree, it holds the potencies of many millions of such fruits. And the fruits can produce another banyan tree that produce so many fruits, would produce so many banyan trees. So the trees and the seeds engage the devotees in meditation about the activities of the Lord, while the mundane wranglers waste time in dry speculation and mental concoction, which are fruitless in both this life and the next. In spite of their pride in speculation, they can never appreciate the simple potential activities of the banyan tree. Such speculators are poor souls, destined to remain in matter perpetually. This is in many ways the universal form is both very important and very difficult to understand, and it's not like you can't go back to Godhead if you don't understand it. It's not like you're disqualified, you have to stay home, stay in the material world if you don't fully understand. But nonetheless, it's important. Therefore, it's presented prominently in Bhagavad Gita, prominently a whole chapter dedicated here, a whole chapter dedicated in the second canto to the universal form because of its importance. There's details to the universal form that are fascinating and complex. But one of the important features is this theological issue, or how does something material come from that which is all spiritual? And there are different ways of answering that question, and based upon the way of answering that question, you get different theologies. It's like it's summoned again. What's the relationship between that which is temporary and that which is eternal, that which is material and that which is spiritual, that which is illusion and that which is reality. How do you get illusion from reality? And there are different ways of addressing that. To say it isn't. It's false. And so many different ways. Even the Vaishnava lines differ specifically in terms of how they explain that difficult to understand matter, or the issue of matter and spirit and the relation between them, or God and His potencies and the relation between them. Repeatedly in these purports, Prabhupada is pointing out or bashing those that hold an impersonal view. An impersonal view fundamentally will say there's no such thing as potency. Because if you have potency, then you have two things. You have potent and potency. You can't have two things, because all there is one thing. So you can't have two things. You can't have potency. Philosophically, they just neutered God. But there's no possibility of doing that. Philosophically, they can juggle. But it doesn't make God impotent. Conversely, Jiva Goswami says in his Sandarbhas that, very simple statement, there's no question of understanding God without accepting the fact that He has inconceivable potency. And if you accept that God has inconceivable potency, then He can do anything because He has inconceivable potency. And then there's just this beautiful art of, or science and art, of understanding how the potencies act under the direction of the potent. And that's what Bhagavatam is doing, unfolding and then winding back up again by the process of creation. And then again, as is described in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, how the creation is wound up again within the body of the Lord. And that's how things of this material world work. They're cyclical. Here Prabhupada is making this description of the beauty of a banyan tree, or the creation of a banyan tree in which it's all cyclical. You can take, you know, different cycles. You can take one season to the next season where fruits are produced. You can take, and with the fruit, there's seeds, and with each seed, there's a banyan tree, and you can produce another banyan tree from each one of the seeds within a particular season's production of banyan trees. And it's a nice example because banyan trees are huge when they're mature. They're huge. You can fill the world with banyan trees just from the seeds of the banyan tree. And you can go in a bigger cycle and say the life of the whole banyan tree, and after some time the banyan tree goes back to earth, which then provides ingredients for the next generation of banyan trees. Recently I was hearing a lecture where Prabhupada was doing the same thing when he was describing the cycle of a grand civilization, and it goes similarly, it exists in cycles. Up, 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 down, 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 down. And how many times has it happened in the history of the world? And, you know, some great civilization or a great dynasty. And then he starts to list those different dynasties in the cycle. And they're gaining power and becoming strong and expanding and gradually over time dwindling and where are they today? And it happens again and again. The Vedic picture of time, you can go, you know, to the universe Or you can take anything, the small, micro or macro, and it's just, they're, time is cyclical. Time brings things into being. Time is there to allow events to take place during the course of the duration of something, and time destroys. And the time energy doesn't stop. So continually things are coming into being and being maintained for some time and going out of being. And this is God's potency that's going on effortlessly, without which you don't have things. You don't have events without time. Because to have events, you have to have past, present, and future. Otherwise, you don't have events. Can you think of an event that doesn't have that? Krishna's pastimes are eternal. But even what does that mean? It's outside of our experience. Because we only know of this kind, events that have past, present, and future. But Krishna's pastimes, they're eternally going on. We understand it this way from the scriptures and Srila Prabhupada's teaching. Just as the sun is rising somewhere on the eastern horizon and setting somewhere on the western horizon, at every moment the sun is rising, the sun is rising, the sun is rising, the sun is rising, the sun is rising. The sun is setting, the sun is setting, the sun is setting. But is the sun rising or setting? The earth is turning, but it's not the sun is coming into being and going out of being. Like events of this world, they come into being and they go out of being. Like this body or whatever, a banyan tree or whatever you can think of this world. It comes into being and stays for some time and goes out of being. Events or a thought or a desire or anything that's of this world. And Krishna's pastimes are eternal. In some universe, Krishna is appearing. In some universe, Krishna is killing the Keshi demons. Krishna's pastimes are eternally going on. And they appear as if it's events like our events. Beginning, lasting for some time, and then ending, like dissolving. But Krishna is not like that, and his pastimes are not like that. And his interaction with his material energy, specifically described by Maitreya, is by his own influence that it happens. I'll go back to a place where in this sixth chapter, we'll go back two things. Toward the very beginning of the chapter, Maitreya is explaining how creation comes into being. And it's the scene is the Supreme Lord is feeling something. And he, amazingly, what he's feeling is incompleteness. The supreme complete whole is feeling incomplete. And that incompleteness is related to his part and parcel living entities who have gone astray. They've turned their attention away from him. And he's feeling incomplete. He's feeling that they should have the opportunity to be in relation with me again. And absent that possibility, he's feeling incompleteness. Like, you know, what's inside the Supreme Lord's heart? It's very confidential. And another thing that he's feeling is that Chaya Devi, the reflection of his own internal potency, Rama Devi, she has nothing to do. And she wants something to do. She wants to do some service for me. So I'd like to give her some service to do. Those two feelings. And effort, effortlessly and lickety-split, like in a flash, his glance upon his external energy sends living entities into the pradhan along with his own time energy. And then the next sequence of things is described, the coming apart or the separating out of the various elements. Then another thing, fast forward, we have all the elements, we have Brahma being manifest from the body of the expansion of Mahavishnu as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, and then we have demigods, just like real fast forward, there's demigods, and the demigods, they're feeling we can't do our service because we don't have the capacity, the strength. So they're praying for that empowerment, the strength and the intelligence and everything that they need in order to, because they have an impetus. They're living entities that are very pious and they want to serve the Lord, but they're feeling like it's not happening. We're not capable of fulfilling the purpose for which we exist. So then the Lord has another feeling. They want to do some service. They don't have the capacity to do the service. And therefore he manifested or expanded his Virat Roop. And the detail of the Virat Roop is described in many different ways. But one of the important components of the Virat Roop is because Virat Roop sees, therefore the eyes can see. Because the Virat Roop has hands, therefore the hands can move and do things that hands are supposed to do. The demigods couldn't do what they wanted to do. We can't do what we want to do without the Virat Roop, and therefore the Lord, to facilitate, he felt, he heard the prayers of the demigods, feeling compassion for their desire for service, he made the Virat Roop manifest. So to step back from the whole picture is, and this whole thing, the cosmic manifestation, is resting upon the Lord's desire, without which we wouldn't have one of these things. And all the other little things, this little smaller circles of cyclical events and seasons and time and histories and dynasties and banyan trees and bodies and all the little subparts, which is also cyclical after some time, it's withdrawn. Those who are wise don't place much value in that which is temporary. We may use that which is temporary in some practical way to serve. We may view, as stated here in this purport, that which is temporary as just part of the magic, using this word, the jugglery, the moving of his energies of the Supreme Lord. When the different darshans or doctrines or vadas of the disciplic successions, Vishishta Dvaita and Dvaita Dvaita, and ours is Achintya Beda Beda Tattva, the one that describes specifically Vyasadeva's teaching, technical language, is Shakti Parinamabad. Have you heard that one before? Shakti means potency. Parinama means transformation. So what Vyasadeva taught our Vaishnav acharyas describe, Vyasadeva's doctrine or vada can be described as Shakti Parinamavad. The supreme Shaktiman, the possessor of potencies, makes arrangements for everything simply by the transformation of his potencies. He is unchanging, while his potencies are moving under his direction. And as his potencies are moving, he's not changing. So back to this specific purport, Jiva Goswami's description that the inconceivable potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are fundamental for understanding God. If you can't accept God has inconceivable potencies, there's no way you're going to understand God. And if you accept that God has inconceivable potencies, then the beginning is made possible to understand God. There's God and His potencies. And there's the spiritual world and there's the material world and there's His spiritual potencies and His material potencies. And all things are exhibitions of His spiritual and material potencies. And devotees are delighting and appreciating how wonderful is God. They're not busying themselves speculating about the whole system. Investigation for the purpose of appreciation, particularly through the descending knowledge process, is very wonderful. Probably some of you here also have had some interactions with Ravindra Sarup Prabhu since the Vedic Planetarium project started taking full swing. But the brilliance of the Vedas with the best of minds of the members of educated members of ISKCON that have PhDs and astrophysics and all kinds of things and studying the technicalities of the Vedic cosmology within Srimad Bhagavatam, it's oceanic. I mean, how deep is the ocean? There must be a bottom to the ocean. Ask BP, they know there's a bottom to the ocean and how to get some oil from there. But you go further out than the Gulf and how deep is the ocean? They must have some kind of machines, seismographs or whatever they are, geological things that can tell you how deep the ocean is. But aside from just theoretically, try to find the bottom of the ocean. Try to find the length and breadth of Vedic cosmology and all the different things and how it actually fits together and have the challenge of putting a design together that those who are the Pafiwafis, the scholars of and scientists of the planet today are going to come and go, that's it. Instead of saying, that's not it. So they're meeting that challenge. Not only Western scientists, but the scholars of the Vedas, Vaishnava and other scholars of the Vedas. It's been a wonderful challenge and exercise for a very brilliant team of devotees to work on. But part of what he shared with me is it's made the devotees appreciate how luminous, not just voluminous, but how bright is the message of the Bhagavatam. Just in those things that are measurable. One of the things that that's a little off track, but I'll come back. I've always appreciated Sataputta as, at least in my little experience of life, the closest person to a genius that I've ever met, or a genius amongst the persons that I've met. I've always had that appreciation for him. So one of the things that I spent some time doing was learning, going a little deeply into the mysteries of the sacred universe presentation that he generated after so many years of contemplating on it. And just one issue out of many is the fact that one of the knee-slapping, make fun of Vedic cosmology things is that the Vedic cosmology is geocentric as opposed to heliocentric. Heliocentric means Copernicus. The sun is at the center. So once upon a time, going back in history, the Vedas and many cosmology groups saw that the Earth is at the center, and planets are moving around the Earth, and their models all had that description. Advancement of technology, Western influence. Copernicus came up with this epiphany, this brilliant realization. It's not that the Earth is at the center, but the Sun is at the center. So then all kinds of cosmology adjustments had to be made because now the Sun is at the center because Copernicus said so. And he used telescopes because prior they didn't have telescopes, so he had like this breakthrough. With telescopes, he could see and then make measurements that were superior to the prior measurements, at least it seemed that way. So with his most advanced, during his time, the size of the Sun, no, excuse me, the distance between the Earth and the Sun was said to be so many miles. And I forget the number now, it's been a long time. I can cover you the memory. But he was off by a factor of something like 50. And then as telescopes got better, then it got closer and closer and closer. And now it's, you know, with Hubble telescopes mounted on spacecraft, they can fly around and take pictures and send them back. And depending upon different positions, they can calculate and they can know the distance between planets and the size of planets. Well, the information found within the Vedas hasn't changed based upon technology, and modern technology is getting closer and closer to the Vedic number of the size of planets and the distance of planets. So, question, how did they know that? They didn't have advanced technology. They didn't have spacecrafts and Hubble telescopes and, you know, send signals back electronically and then measure them in all the ways that they do those things. So how'd they know? It's descending knowledge. It's Vedic knowledge that's descending. So now, well, wait a minute, descending knowledge. Is the Sun at the center and are planets moving around the Sun, or is it the other way around? The first time I made this presentation on Mysteries of the Sacred Universe, it was at UC Davis in California. And I'll do this slowly. It's a Friday night, you've been, you know, had a hard week at work and maybe a little, okay, difficult, so pay attention. Here's the Earth. How do we do this? I'm looking for the right memory file here. Doing a little memory scan. Srinandanandana knows about that one. Yeah. The difference has to do with if we take the Sun as the center, the Sun is the center and the planet Earth is moving around the Sun. Okay, that's easy. And now we have the Moon that's moving around the Sun as the Earth moves around, the Moon is moving around the Earth as the Earth moves around the Sun. Yes? When you map that out, what do you get? You're looking at it, you know, from the top looking down. There's the sun. There's the earth moving around the sun. And then there's the planets. There's the moon moving around the earth. So it's a helix or a spiral. And you just keep doing that a few hundred thousand times. And what do you get? You get a disk. You get a three-dimensional disk, but vertically it's a disk with an outer and inner rim. And that's the orbit of the moon as the moon is moving around the earth and the earth is moving around the sun, right? A disk with an outer and inner parameter. So now let's do this. We have the point of observation. That's the Earth. And the Earth has this situation where there's a movement of the sun in relation to the Earth. It's the winter time, so it's like, you know, whatever it is, January 14th is the winter solstice. So the sun is, for those in the northern hemisphere, the sun is at its lowest point. The sun is moving. Summer is highest, zenith, and it moves down in a southerly direction until it hits the lowest part, and it's the winter. And then there's two points where the day and nights are equal. Equinox, I believe it's called. Summer solstice, winter solstice, and equinox. And so the sun is moving on an ecliptic plane, is what it's called. And once a year it makes that movement. Yes? So if you were to map out, looking from the top down, you're to map out the movements of the planets that are moving around the sun as the sun is moving on its ecliptic plane around the earth. You get that same spiral in 1 year's time, and you do it over a long period of time, and you get that same band, a little lifesaver, you know, something with an outer and inner rim, and it's got, it's like an inner tube. It has a little dimension, vertical dimension too. But don't look at the vertical dimension, it has an outer and inner radius away from the Earth, because the Earth is the point of observation. It's practical. You just do the math a little differently, but the Vedic numbers of this plane of Bhumandal with the rings of oceans and land and oceans, we don't find any islands that are like that, that are circular with an inner and outer, and inside there's a body of water, and then inside. It's the motion, that those dimensions are the various planets in our solar system. As those planets are moving about the sun, as the sun is moving on its ecliptic plane around the earth, with very precise numbers. Not just precise because they have like a real, you know, like a number to them, but corresponding to what modern science, very close to what modern science is saying, or say it the other way. Modern science is now very closely getting it together enough to get the distances between the Earth and the other planets and the Sun and the other planets. Geocentric, not goofy. It's just different math. It's sophisticated math, but it's practical. It's from the point of observation. Because once they have these different planetary influences, they can, once they have the astronomy figured out, they can have astrology figured out. And based upon astrology, there's an agrarian culture, when to plant your crops and when to harvest the crop. You know, they can know ahead of time all these things, when to do so many things, because of that science. Because they had qualified brahmanas that their brains were sharp. And they could understand these things very deeply. And they used this science in very practical ways. So maybe some of you have heard, excuse me for getting off the topic a little bit, but it's not really. There's a discovery, maybe some of you heard, that they now think maybe, just maybe, there's life on other planets. Have you read that one? There's like something. What's the detail? Did you read it? Srinandanandana? Arsenic. There's some bacteria that survives. It lives on arsenic. And there's not the sulfur, phosphorus, and sodium and other things that, you know, make up these things. So there may be other life that survives in other things besides what we have. Maybe. And as they're, from my perspective, as their capacity to measure things from Copernicus's time to Hubble's telescope time, they're going to find, they may find themselves becoming closer and closer and closer to a Vedic model. Because somebody, this is on our GBC conference, somebody commented, you know, when are they going to understand that there's a spirit soul separate from this body? And Rasaraj put in a little quote from Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada is saying, they don't, but the day may come when scientists will come to that conclusion. By, you know, like this. Instead of this. And we're getting, you know, this. We're getting the direct from Maitreya Muni, who heard it directly from Krishna, and he's describing the potencies of the personality Godhead are unlimited. Even the personality of Godhead can't measure them completely, so what to speak of anyone else? That's the position of a Vaishnava. And so what does a Vaishnava do when they see the inconceivable potencies of the Lord at work? They marvel. What? How wonderful is my Lord? I remember as a very new devotee, we had these different nomenclatures, like, you know, ISKCON lingo, like, it's bona fide, Prabhu. That was one of them. And another one was fixed up, because Prabhupada was, used the phrase of, you know, being fixed up at the lotus feet of Krishna. So, lost my train of thought. Help Krishna. Lost it. Well, anyway, maybe it will come back. The discussion here is about understanding the inconceivable potencies of the personality of Godhead. So, I'll read the last verse. Words, mind, and ego, with their respective controlling demigods, have failed to achieve success in knowing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we simply have to offer our respectful obeisances unto him as a matter of sanity. I remembered. So, one of the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, is it okay to appreciate a sunset or a beautiful rose, something beautiful in nature, it's like, you know, is it bona fide? Is it okay? You're Maya Prabhu. That was another one. So, is it? The very language, you know, you're Maya Prabhu. And the tone is like, it doesn't fit. But anyway, so is it Maya to see something beautiful in nature and appreciate something beautiful in nature? And Prabhupada's reply was, yes, you can think, how wonderful is my Lord. Just see the beauty of His creation. Just see this beautiful sunset. And then you're not in Maya Prabhu. You're appreciating the creation of the personality of Godhead. As he's speaking here about the banyan tree. And you know, you can spin out all you like about how wonderful the personality of Godhead is. Just see. Like that nice example of the cobbler who was accepting that the personality of Godhead was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. Lord Narayan was doing that. And when Narada Muni told the cobbler, he said, oh, very nice. How can you accept that? If he can place within a seed of a banyan tree, hundreds of banyan trees within that little seed. And banyan trees are so big, and it's within that, hundreds of them within that little seed. Why he can't put an elephant through the eye of a needle? Inconceivable potencies are easy for him. For us, it's inconceivable. For him, it's his potencies. So to appreciate the majesty, whenever in the presence of some Grand Canyon, or you know, even Americans like to go to such places and see the beauty of nature. It's not just spacing out on being in Maya. It's awe-inspiring. Huge, huge mountain. Something like, you know, the opulences of the Absolute that are mentioned in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And those are but little portions of God's potencies. His potency is inconceivable. That's the message. Words, mind, and ego, with their respective controlling demigods, have failed to achieve success in knowing the Supreme Personality of God. And therefore, we simply have to offer our respectful obeisances unto Him as a matter of sanity. Thus ends the sixth chapter, Canto 3. So how are we to know, the purport is, how are we to know an unknown object? And for that matter, an unknowable object, how are we to know it? And the answer is, if the unknowable object discloses, then you can know. And because Krishna is a person, he kindly discloses to those who are eager to hear and receive in proper manner, then he certainly is not restricted from disclosing what his energies are and how his energies are working. And his devotee, Maitreya Muni, is disclosing all of that to his capacity, as he is heard and as he is assimilated. And that's the way of devotional service. The hearing and chanting process is essential to the devotional process. And we're very mercifully been engaged in that by our founder Acharya. And all different backgrounds of people from all different socioeconomic places. Something that I'll just end with this. I'm appreciating. I spent some time in China when I was the chairman of the GBC. I thought, here's one quarter of the world's population no one has been to. these, you know, from our executive committee, will probably be a nice signal to those one quarter of the world's population if the GBC chairman visits the place and says, you know, you people are important. So I did that. And since I've gone there, maybe you all have noticed, as I have noticed, the one quarter of the world's population is not just staying in that part of the world. It's going all over the world. I mean, there are a lot of Chinese people in American universities today, yes? A lot. I mean, a lot, especially in graduate school. When I was writing, if you go on, I think it's 270, you go around the loop around Washington, D.C., and there's a thing that goes up northwest. I forget which, it's Interstate 73 or 273 or something. And there's a Citibank, and there's a sign, Citibank, and just below it, it's in Chinese. You know, the heartland of America, the suburbs of our nation's capital, Citibank in Chinese. Huh? It's not in Spanish, it's in Chinese. And just before coming here, I was in Chicago and, you know, met two graduate students at Northwestern University that are, you know, they had never been to a Hare Krishna temple. One devotee brought them, and you know, there isn't the devotees that with the BBT that were translating from English to Chinese. They had a hard problem translating Bhagavad Gita because there aren't words in the Chinese language for God. There aren't words in the Chinese language for consciousness. They have this big issue between this group and that group that says it should be this word or that word. Because there isn't a word. There isn't a word for God. Huh? I mean, we've got at least two or three. God, Lord, Supreme. They don't have one. And in Sanskrit, how many are there? I mean, Sarva Vishnu Sahasranam, just for starters. They don't have one. And why not? Because there isn't a concept, because words are symbols of something, and they don't even have a concept. So they don't have a word. And how are those people going to become Hare Krishna devotees? They don't even have a concept. Think about it for like half a minute. A second. It's like, it's a mind-blowing phenomenon. But they're becoming really wonderful devotees. From chanting Hare Krishna, you know, I've watched them doing Dhammadurastakam prayers, like, you know, they just want to wait till the next day and do the next Dhammadurastakam prayer. They're really happy in devotional life. It's very natural because it's from the soul. It doesn't matter culture, language, you know, what government you have and the whole thing. It's of the soul. And this appreciation of the inconceivable potencies of God and how He makes this creation manifest to accommodate the errant living entity's desire. That's what the subject of the whole chapter is. How He does it. It's why He does it and then how He does it. And describing it is wonderful. Although it's kind of technical and mind-bending, it's wonderful. And it's purifying for the reader and the reciter and the hearer. So that ends chapter 6. Creation of the universal form. Any comments or questions? Wow, it's late.
Hey,
I'm wrong.
Some things that we have to offer that so integral, like a reference point of the Lord's peace on earth, you know, the significance of leaving off the human animals, you know, the holy name, you know, people trying to will peace when actually we know it can't be done without God. So all these things, if we make any concerted effort as a movement to...
No.
No?
No. Maybe we should, but we're not. But, you know, just like the last, one of the times I was here and that gentleman from Sri Lanka came and made his, you know, world one piece thing. I don't know if Prabhupada got on those bandwagons as a, you know, a vehicle for promoting Krishna consciousness. I remember seeing a video of Hari Vilas shared with me was the video that I saw. It was in San Francisco, where Yogi Bhajan had invited Prabhupada to have a discussion with him. And Yogi Bhajan was, like, the video that I saw was Yogi Bhajan was waving with his arms, "Swamiji, you're very powerful in this world, and lots of people listen to you, as many people listen to me. Let us bring all the spiritual leaders together and love one another," and like that. And Prabhupada cut him off and said, "They will never." I didn't get to see the rest of the video where that conversation went, but his point was, same as the point upstairs, remember that, you know, without God at the center, it will never. So we can make our appeal for peace, but it's on that platform, and people don't want to go there. We're like, you know, a sore thumb. See, if the hammer just smashed the thumb, and we're this painful sore thumb. That's my experience. You know, the audience up here, they didn't want to hear our message. It means surrender. They didn't even want to hear become vegetarian. You remember when you asked him the question? You remember? I remember. And he gave such a milquetoast answer, it was embarrassing. His answer was, "Well, if you can do that, that would be best." And then you know, right behind his words, you said, "So you're saying it's not necessary." You take it, "No, I'm not saying that. I'm just being milquetoast." You know, they don't want to take a stand on anything. It's the, let's get together and love one another and bond. Means equal sense gratification. I don't have a lot of enthusiasm for those kinds of gatherings. Personally, maybe it's just not, you know, my flavor of ice cream or something.
One more point.
Go ahead.
So there's something else called, you know, this, the concept of the secret, as you see, where your attention goes.
The children are louder than you are.
Okay. Well, it seems like as we see, we see what we want to see. We see what we want to bring out. Like the metaphysical principle, we don't understand who we are. We have to see that in others also. So it seems like it's built into our philosophy is when we look at like non-devotees, so to speak, or even put down people that, I think there's a part of everybody that really wants to understand this.
Sure.
But as long as they're thinking that they're not going to understand it, or they're not interested, then it's less likely to happen.
Good point. So you go to that forum because you see it, and I don't go to those forums because I don't see it.
I mean, oral interactions.
Huh?
I'm talking about oral interactions with devotees with anybody else, not any forums, but just in our daily interactions. If we see the good in each other. We see the devotees in other people.
Yeah. Good point. Very nice point. Here's my response. For me personally, in America today, there are a lot of people seeking spirituality, unlike what I've experienced in the past 3 decades or 2.5 decades. They're young Americans are looking, they're searching. I just, you know, did a few college programs. 3-4 people came after the University of Illinois program saying, I'm looking for spiritual life. Can you give me some idea of how I can get guidance? Huh? Say it again, please. But their idea of seeking guidance is not what we're thinking. They've got a whole other paradigm. So, but that's kind of like, that's more, at least with whatever time I have available, I'm interested in that low-hanging fruit and providing the right association and tools for those people. Something like what Prabhupada did during his time. It was similarly a time when young people were seeking. They're seeking. They're not like, we have to go find them. They're seeking. They're coming to us. They've got other ideas. So there was like 2 or 3 of them. And one of them said, yeah, and I'm trying to meditate, but I have a really hard time meditating. I can't fix my mind on the impersonal feature of the Absolute Truth. He didn't use that language. And another one said, oh, I've got it. And there's this product, such and such organization. You had a vibration in this ear and a vibration in that ear, and it like stabilizes your vibrations, and then you can meditate better. I said, oh, how do I find one of those? The spiritual marketplace has so much out there of modalities of, but that existed during our time as well. And as you said, somebody wants the genuine thing. I may be like, in a battle against Maya, all parts of army, air force, infantry, you know, guys with pea shooters and guys with, you know, everybody, all different parts of the army are needed. So I'm responding from a personal perspective. That those young American people, we need, they want and we need. we need to make that connection. And, you know, the bigger, I'll leave that to somebody else that knows how to do that. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. I'm responding just in a more personal way, that's something that resonates really well with me. I'm feeling very, in fact, I'll say it, we need such people. We need really sharp, dedicated, you know, and thoughtful, forward-thinking individuals. It's been, we got this big cavity in our Hare Krishna movement. We don't have those people that used to be the ones that were making everything happen. They're out there. They're going to find something else if they don't find Hare Krishna devotees. We need to get out there and connect with those people and help them make, you know, a couple steps in the right direction. And then they'll begin to practice with the right association. That's what resonates especially with me. And this other resonates especially with you, and, you know, all power to you. Bring those people to Krishna's temple and Krishna's lotus feet, and, or at least one step closer to, you know, a clearer understanding of what's what. I would like to just like stop everything that I'm doing and just do that. What I just mentioned. It's so important. We need future leaders. They're ready to like sign up. We need to do that. I feel very strongly about it. So anyway. Anyone else? Comment? Question? Yes.
God is beautiful, then there has to be something more beautiful than that. this tranquility is a quality. So how can Supreme have quality? They are measured of things or something. If you put this quality on Supreme, then that means someone else can be more than that always, possibly.
Why? If you're speaking of the potencies of the personality of Godhead, why must there be, by inference, someone more powerful?
They're comparable things. So how can you put God into the comparable things? God is in his own class, separate class.
Yes, he is. But he has his material opulences that are but reflections of his spiritual opulences. I'm not sure I've got what the problem is. Okay, you think about it, we'll ask me again. The material, what we're getting from Maitreya is even the material portion is inconceivable. But to some extent we can describe that through the medium of what we have heard and what we have assimilated. And what Prabhupada is adding is by practical experience, like the banyan tree example. That's not the limit of God's potency, but it's part of his, he's using this word because it's in the verse, jugglery. How he moves his energies and does these amazing things with his energies. So it's appreciation. How wonderful is my Lord? It's not saying that now I know the limit. The next verse says even the Lord doesn't know the limit of his own potencies. So how can some little individual like us? So it's not a question of limiting God and saying, well, if you say these are his potencies, then there must be something greater by inference. Whatever you say, it's not the limit. Even something that's measurable, like, you know, the Himalayas, there's a limit. But that's not his limit. You say Mount Meru, but that's not his limit either. It's just one of his little potencies. Class is over. I go. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.